morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Lakeview Technologies against Robinson. Mr. Howe.
May it please the court, counsel. The question on appeal today deals with whether the district court properly denied Plaintiff Lakeview's motion for preliminary injunction.
Mr. Howe, before you begin, there's a preliminary that I'd like to get out of the way, and that is this. Mr. Robinson's obligations under the non-compete clause expire next month, and it also appears that Lakeview is just beginning a new sales year. The strategy for which I presume was developed after Mr. Robinson's departure from Lakeview. How does that affect the need for a preliminary injunction here?
2 points, Your Honor. First, while we are approaching the one-year anniversary of Mr. Robinson's resignation, the employment agreement at issue provides that for each period of a violation, the restriction for the non-solicitation is extended 1 month during that violation. So that if we are able to establish, as we believe we will, that Mr. Robinson and his employer have been in violation of these covenants, then the time period is extended. And a subsidiary related point to that, Your Honor, is that the confidentiality obligation is an open-ended one. As to Your Honor's second issue dealing with the fact that our client, as is common in this high availability software industry, adopts one-year sales plans, it is true that information here is in some sense a wasting asset, but the fact that a company has a particular sales plan in the year 2000 does not mean that when it comes to the year 2001 that prior sales plan and knowledge of the prior sales plan is of no value whatsoever. There will be some changes that will be made, I'm quite sure. There will be some items that are still kept, but the confidentiality of the information remains an interest of Lakeview, and Lakeview is entitled to have that confidential information protected even beyond the one-year time period. Therefore, Your Honor, we don't believe that this is an issue in which this case is moot. We believe that this case still remains a live one, and we believe that the issues here are ones that are certainly relevant to the party's conduct going forward.
I have a related question. What's happening in the district court?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting point, and what's happening in the district court
is...
It's
not a point, it's a question.
There are two proceedings in the district court. In the original action, which is Lakeview versus Robinson, we are still in the midst of discovery. We had taken during the proceedings below that led up to the appeal a deposition of Mr. Robinson. We had deposed his immediate supervisor, Mr. Massey. We had presented Mr. Merchants, who's the CEO of Lakeview, for a deposition. We obtained documents. We produced documents. Since then, we have noticed up additional depositions, in particular the depositions of Messrs. Arnold and Vlock, V-L-O-K for Mr. Vlock. They're higher-level superiors of Vision, Mr. Robinson's current employer. We've also had disputed motions to compel, which have been most recently granted in part and denied in part by Magistrate Judge Denlow. The district court had referred the discovery conduct to the magistrate judge. In light of the party's ruling, or the court's ruling, the parties entered into an agreement that Robinson and Vision would supplement prior discovery productions that would be conducted by a review of various emails that were exchanged between and among Mr. Robinson and his colleagues at Vision that relate to the identity of various Lakeview customers and partners. Now, because the identity of these Lakeview customers and partners is itself confidential, and we couldn't turn that over to Vision to have their IT people do it, a third-party consultant was brought in. He's collected information. It's in the hands of opposing counsel for review. It's yet to be produced. When it's produced, we'll take the additional depositions. That's the first case, Your Honor. Does Your Honor have a question regarding the first case?
Well, the question to which this leads is, why should we be fighting about a preliminary injunction hearing when you appear to be moving toward a permanent injunction hearing? I mean, the goal of the preliminary injunction was to bridge the time until you could get to a trial. It looks like you're moving toward a trial. It's very difficult to see what purpose would be served with a remand that tells the district judge to hold two trials, one now and another after you're done with discovery. What interest would be served by multiple trials in this case?
Your Honor, if this were a case as where, for example, I believe Abbott versus Mead Johnson, the infant formula case, where the parties were on the eve of trial, then I would suggest that the interest that we would have as the plaintiff appellant and that the public would have in the conservation of resources would be much less, and that there would be less of a need for a trial. But we're not on the eve of a trial. We don't even have summary judgment, dispositive motion deadlines. There is a discovery cutoff that's set, but we don't have dispositive motion deadline that's set. In addition, there is no trial date that has been set.
Well, and you're sort of getting to the problem. No, I can understand the argument that if trial is far off, there's still something to be served. But now what we're talking about is trial. First, you want a trial on a poor record, and then a trial on a better record soon to follow. And at some point, we get to the point where instead of having a trial on a skimpy record with another trial soon to follow, you say, no, let's wait till we've got the record, and then we'll handle this in damages. Right? It's a year late, basically. The district judge may be wrong, but it's not clear how we can improve things now. That's the question I'm asking you to address.
And, Your Honor,
maybe there should have been an injunction pending appeal.
It's an interesting point, Your Honor. We think that there's a private interest and a public interest in the disposition of this case. As to the private interest, I've described the first pending case. Let me mention to you the second pending related case below, and then address the public interest. In addition to the lawsuit...
Excuse me, before you do that, but both of those pending cases request damages.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
In addition to the lawsuit that Lakeview has brought against Robinson, Lakeview, in the discovery below, discovered that, we believe, evidence that Vision had induced breach of duties by Robinson and had also entered into a conspiracy with Robinson and others. One of the key facts that we learned, for example, and Your Honors are aware from the record, that Mr. Robinson, when he accepted his job to go to work to my client, Lakeview's principal competitor, Vision, had repeatedly lied to about a dozen of his colleagues at Lakeview about that.
It may be unfair to break in right now, but you're so good at this, I'm sure you'll be able to pick up your train of thought. That was something that I wanted to ask about, and you've jogged my memory, because in the briefs, what you noted was that an evidentiary hearing was necessary to address Mr. Robinson's credibility. But it certainly seems to me that Judge Koukouras has already assessed Robinson's credibility and assumed that he is not credible. So if we start from that point, why in the world would we, you know, want to go back there for an evidentiary hearing? And maybe you can weave that into whatever it is you're arguing at this point.
Thank you. I will get to your point in connection with answering Judge Easterbrook's question. With respect to the second action, Lakeview versus Vision, Mr. Massey, and another gentleman, Mr. Campbell, that case is just beginning. The defendants have each appeared. We're in motions prac. One defendant, the corporate defendant, has answered. The others are in motions practice. So we, in a very real sense, are even further away from any type of complete and full record, because not only do we have the question of facts as we now know them, not only is there the possibility of a fuller record in the first case, but there's going to be ongoing discovery and ultimately a trial on the merits in the third case. And so from the private interest, we don't believe that our client's interest, which are protectable. The district court found that these are trade secrets. The district court found that the damages could be large if our client's rights were violated. The district court found, in particular, with the trade secrets.
Is there any risk that the defendants won't be good for the damages?
With respect to Mr. Robinson, he's an individual, and you always have that particular question.
Yes.
With respect to Vision is an American, wholly owned subsidiary, American subsidiary of a South African company. The South African company has issued recently various...
I don't care about the parent company. They're not liable for their subsidiaries' debts. Is Vision solvent? That's
well,
all I want to know.
The parent company has issued profit warnings related to the lack of profitability of its operations, primarily those in the United States. And therefore, I can offer no assurance now and have no confidence that the corporate defendant would be liable for damages, would be able to satisfy a judgment for damages. And in any event, the corporate defendant is not a defendant in the case before this court. Your Honor, I had said that there was a private interest and a public interest. I addressed the private interest. Bear with
obviously
me,
the Titanic is trying to send an SOS.
The last time I was here, it was oral argument by one of my partners, and there were three fire alarms during the oral argument. So this is a relatively minor interruption. In terms of the public interest, I think that it's worthwhile to provide some greater guidance for the courts in terms of the conduct of preliminary injunctions. I see the lights on, so I'll be brief because I want to save a bit of time for rebuttal. But there's little precedent on this precise procedural posture. Cases generally come to this court either with a preliminary injunction or a preliminary injunction hearing or without a hearing. In the event that there's no hearing, then it's generally a preliminary injunction has been entered without a hearing. Sometimes they're affirmed, sometimes they're reversed. If they're reversed, it's generally on a lack of notice, due process grounds. If they're affirmed, it's generally on the grounds that there wasn't a need because the opposing party wasn't able to establish that there were material facts in dispute that would weaken the movement's case. But in terms of this posture where there's a movement seeking a preliminary injunction and it's denied without a hearing, there's actually a paucity of case law. And we would suggest that for various reasons that it would be worthwhile to have a hearing in this case. The decision whether to grant a preliminary injunction is one that this court has counseled is a subjective and intuitive one. The district court below engaged in a balancing of harms. In order to properly balance harms and to reach a subjective, intuitive decision, you need a record upon which you can operate. PepsiCo is a good example. In that case, the district court originally had granted a TRO, denied it because it was concerned about irreparable harms and balance of harms, held a hearing, and then ultimately issued the injunction.
Well, he didn't, you know, make a finding out of thin air here exactly, did he? I mean, in other words, you know, he felt that Vision had its own agreement with Robinson that required him to have nothing to do with Lakeview's sales territory. He felt, you know, that he found that there was no evidence that Robinson had breached his agreement by disclosing or making use of any confidential information or, you know, attempting to solicit any of Lakeview's clients. I mean, he didn't make it out of thin air.
I'm not suggesting that the district court below reached a decision out of thin air. I am suggesting that there were disputed issues of material fact and a balancing of harms that was made basically preferring one set of papers over another without any assessment of the credibility of the witnesses.
But let me just ask you this, following up on what Judge Rovner said. Those facts that the court found that she just alluded to, there was no evidence presented to the contrary. I mean, they're in the papers, correct? That he had actually gone out and solicited clients, that, you know, that string of things she listed, there was nothing to dispute that. I understand there was lots of discussion about what Robinson said or didn't say, but the district court found in your favor that way. He just made the assumption that he wasn't credible.
That's correct, Your Honor, and if I could bear with the court's patience because I see that the light's moved on. That's one of the errors that we believe that the court had made, because the court... A premise for the court's decision below is that we had failed to identify any particular customers that were lost, or that Mr. Robinson had in fact solicited customers or had in fact used customers. And we believe that that is one of the errors of law that was committed, because as this court's decision in Hess-Newmark suggests, the mere inability of a plaintiff movement for preliminary injunction to identify a particular loss does not disentitle that plaintiff from preliminary relief. In fact, were that the case, it would vitiate the purpose of a preliminary injunction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howe. Mr. Lancelotti.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. The district court, Your Honors, did not abuse its discretion in denying Lakeview's request for a preliminary injunction without conducting an evidentiary hearing. As Your Honors are aware, this court gives great deference to the district court's decision on whether to conduct an evidentiary hearing and whether to deny or grant the preliminary injunction.
Can you deal with the mootness point as well? Because I'm concerned about that area. Do you have the same view as...
With the fact that it's expiring.
Right.
I believe that moots this, and in a month it's going to be moot. And counsel.
But he said there were some provisions.
Right. He said there's a provision that it extends if it's being dishonored.
Well, there's a provision in the contract which provides for that, but I believe that that.
Well, then it's certainly not moot. Well, we're just in the world of prudence, not of mootness.
Yeah, I believe that that provision, though, Your Honor, is vague and ambiguous.
No. That's your defense. Mm-hmm. Having a defense doesn't make a case moot. It means you have an argument. But an argument for the defense doesn't make a case moot. So
that is what they're relying on. There is an extender clause in the contract.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And then there's in the confidentiality clause, there's no time limit.
Yes,
on
and there
that.
Is
so
a confidentiality
clause. So that's what I meant
clause.
In terms of you agreed with him. That
I agree that those are in there. I don't agree that they're enforceable.
Let me ask you a global question. Robinson lied about why he was leaving Lakeview. We all agree about that, don't we?
Yes.
Okay. He concedes it.
Yes.
Right. And Vision appears to have gone along with his deception. What reason would we have to believe that either one of them will abide by Robinson's contractual obligations not to disclose Lakeview's secrets?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that Vision went along with his deception. I don't believe there was any evidence that Vision was, except for Mr. Massey.
What I hope I said was appears to have gone along with his deception.
Okay.
So whether you believe it or not, I think, you know, let's look at the appearance of impropriety here.
Sure. I believe, Your Honor, that the evidence shows that Vision and Robinson both have gone to great lengths to implement procedures voluntarily on their own, which essentially almost reaches the relief that Lakeview was looking for, in that they put in what Judge Kokoris refers to as filtering mechanisms. And there's two places that those appear. One is in Mr. Robinson's employment agreement with Vision. That has a provision in there that prohibits Eric from contacting, soliciting customers that he previously dealt with.
Right, but hasn't Vision slipped up on its own efforts to keep Robinson isolated from Lakeview's customers, and territory by copying Robinson on certain emails that, you know, should never have been copied on?
Well, if those two emails that you're referring to, Your Honor, those came up after Mr. Robinson returned back to work after the TRO was dissolved. There were two instances, one in which an email was inadvertently sent to Mr. Robinson involving a customer in Illinois, and as soon as that was sent to Mr. Robinson, he was inadvertently copied on the email. Mr. Robinson's boss, Stephen Massey, sent out an email to all the individuals involved reminding them of the restrictions that had been placed on Mr. Robinson and instructing everyone not to copy Mr. Robinson on any emails that would involve customers that are identified in a September 14th email from in-house counsel for Vision.
But I mean, your argument, of course, is that it was inadvertent. Their argument is, wait a minute, this is proof of the kind of thing that is happening, can happen, you know, once the horsey is out of the barn.
I agree. We do not dispute that the email was sent, but their inference of the email is what we're disputing. They're inferring that means Vision's not protecting.
But if we're in a world of inference, one normally has a trial to worry about inference. Let me put a variation of Judge Rovner's question, because it's what troubles me. I mean, your client is a confessed liar. He concedes that he's willing to lie when that serves his economic interests. And indeed, he has lied in connection with these very transactions. And yet, the reason the district court declined to hold a hearing is the judge presumed that your client is telling the gospel truth. Isn't that rather hard to presume of a confessed liar?
Your Honor, I, again, respectfully disagree that the court found that Mr. Robinson was professing the truth. I think just the opposite is true. The court specifically said it discredited Eric Robinson and assumed the worst about him. And given that...
It seems to me if you assume the worst about Robinson, then an injunction issues as a matter of course.
Well, he assumed the worst about Robinson with respect to whether he's credible or not, but that did not go to any material fact which was relevant to the issues for obtaining a preliminary injunction.
Material fact is whether he will keep his promise not to solicit old customers, not to hand over any of the information.
Right.
If he doesn't keep that promise, then an injunction is obviously needed.
Here
we have a liar. As I say, your client concedes he's a liar, who makes a promise, and the judge says, I believe he'll keep it. Oh.
The district court, in addition to considering that fact that Eric Robinson had lied and was not credible, also considered the lack of any evidence to show that he had done anything, that he had solicited any customers, that he had lured away any business from Lakeview to Vision.
It's just not logical. I mean, you know, we're in the business of logic here. Is it logical to say the man's a liar and the man says, yes, I'm a liar, I concede I'm a liar, and then to go forward and say, he's a liar, but he's not going to lie?
Again, Your Honor, we concede that the court found that Mr. Robinson had little or no credibility with respect to the issues that had happened involving his leaving Lakeview and coming to Vision. But what the court did find that there was no material fact in dispute were going down the elements of the preliminary injunction. And the court found, with respect to the likelihood of success on the merits, that there was no evidence that Mr. Robinson had taken or that he had used or divulged any information, that he had contacted any customers and solicited Lakeview customers, and that he had not induced Vision Lakeview customers to leave and go to Vision. In addition to that, there were filtering mechanisms put in place by Vision Solutions, which are clearly identified in the September 15th email from Christine Brooks, where Vision took him out of the geographies that he had previously worked in for Lakeview, took him completely out, whether it would be working for a Vision customer or a Lakeview customer. He has no choice. He's not even in that territory. In addition to that, he's not allowed to solicit any Lakeview customers that he previously worked with at Lakeview. So you had these mechanisms that Vision and Robinson put in place. You have the lack of any evidence of him taking, using, or soliciting customers. And in addition to that, the court found that the lapse in time made it even less likely that this trade secret information would be divulged by Mr. Robinson. So that culminated into the court's decision to deny not only a preliminary injunction, but a request for an evidentiary hearing. And in order to overturn that, Your Honors would have to find that no reasonable person could take the view that was adopted by the district court. And I believe that the evidence supports the finding of the district court that it did not abuse its discretion in reaching that decision.
Mr. Lancelotti, how long do you think it'll be before this case comes on for trial on the merits?
I believe it's not long for trial because we have two depositions left of Vision employees that are scheduled for this month. After that, discovery is closed. Those are the only two depositions remaining. We're back in front of Judge Kokoris, I believe, later this month, and at that time I would expect that a trial would be set. A briefing on perhaps any motions for summary judgment, and then a trial soon thereafter.
Soon thereafter. What's Judge Kokoris's normal time between a close of discovery and trial in an equity action these days?
That, Your Honor, I'm unsure of how soon that would be after.
Has he set a summary judgment motion schedule?
He has not yet. He has just set the close of discovery. And Your Honor, I want to point out also, in addition to this issue about the credit...
And what do we know about the solvency of the parties? Is Mr. Robinson willing to post, say, a $5 million bond?
I'm not sure if Mr. Robinson has the means to post a $5 million bond, Your Honor.
Is Vision willing to post one for him?
I am not aware if they are willing to post a bond of $5 million.
Possibility, if you really don't want an injunction pending trial, instead of just relying on Mr. Robinson's word, one could post a bond. And the district judge said something like that. The judge said, well, you know, if he doesn't honor his word, surely the penalties will be horrendous, so he will honor his word. But the horrendous penalties count only if they can be paid. And that implies something like posting security. You know, posting a $5 or $10 million bond to avoid an injunction here would certainly be an option for Vision.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of whether they have the ability or are willing to post it for Mr. Robinson.
Well, as soon as you say I'm worried about whether they have the ability, that makes an injunction look all the more urgent.
And I, Your Honor, I misspoke when I said that. I have no reason to believe that they don't for themselves. I just don't know if they're willing to post it for Mr. Robinson. But, Your Honor, in addition to, and I see the light has gone on, in addition to the lack of any evidence that supports a likelihood of success on the merits, Lakeview also failed in the other elements of the preliminary injunction, which by themselves would have been enough to deny a preliminary injunctive relief. And that is something that Lakeview doesn't dispute. In both their breach of contract actions, district court found that they could not and did not establish an inadequate remedy at law or irreparable harm. And with respect to the trade secrets action, the court found that they did not present evidence sufficient to show irreparable harm. That alone was enough to deny the motion. In addition, on top of that, the balance of harms weighed in favor of Mr. Robinson, according to the district court, that to sit him out completely was much more harmful than to have him work in this limited capacity, given the mechanisms that were put in place.
If he didn't want to sit out completely, he shouldn't have signed the no-compete contract. I mean, I have very little sympathy for intelligent adults who sign contracts and then when they violate their contracts deliberately say, well, it would be hard on my client to keep their word.
Your Honor, the non-compete that is in dispute prevented him from soliciting customers that he had dealt with at Lakeview. And that's exactly what the provisions...
I don't know how hard, then, why is it hard on him to be required by injunction on penalty of contempt to keep his promise? If that's all the no-compete requires, and your client has pledged that he won't violate it, why is it hard on him? When you say it's hard on him only if he wants to do something the no-compete clause prohibits.
It would be hard on him, Your Honor, to sit out completely. We have put this in place that does prevent him from contacting those customers. Lakeview wants more. Lakeview wants him to sit out completely, and they won't settle for just putting him out of contact with his former customers at Lakeview. That is something we did voluntarily and remains in place today. In conclusion, Your Honors, Lakeview's appeal lacks any factual evidence or legal analysis demonstrating that the district court committed an error of fact or law, and as such, Lakeview failed to demonstrate that the court abused its discretion in denying either the motion for preliminary injunction or the request for an evidentiary hearing, and therefore we request that the appellate court affirm the district court's denial of those motions. Unless the court has any other questions,
Thank you, Mr. Lancelotti.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Howe, we took you well away from the merits for a while, so I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I would be pleased to answer any questions the court might have. Otherwise, I'll wait for my rebuttal. I made my points before.
Looks like there are none.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement. We'll